House Labor and Commerce will now come to order. It's 3:15 p.m. on Wednesday, January 28th. Present, we have Representative Tilton, Representative Josephson, Representative Keto, myself, Chair Olson. We do have a forum to conduct business. Please turn off your cell phones or you'll be buying the next round of food for next week. Today, the only item on the agenda is a overview from the Department of Administration, and for some of us, it's Groundhog Day because several of us are on the Admin Budget Subcommittee and got to go through this again last night. But please join us, Commission, at the table and do just like you did last night. Presentation looks awfully familiar.
Well, thank you for having me. Yes, there will be a few additions, but much of it will be a repeat.
Excuse me. Let the record reflect we've been joined by Representative Ledoux, who's only 2 minutes late.
Sorry.
She has an excuse, so she had a committee next to her. Please continue.
Great. Thank you. So we do have a presentation. I would like to encourage any questions that come up as we go through, and I'm happy to pause and respond as needed.
One last item. We've been joined by the rest of the committee now. We've got Representative Hughes and Representative Colbert with us, so we do have the full committee. Won't be interrupting you again because they're all here.
No worries. Please interrupt as you need. So starting with slide 2, this is just an overview of the commission, or the department. We will go through some of these in a little more detail, so I won't spend a lot of time, but I think it's important to recognize that an important function of...
Commissioner, can I get you to state your name and affiliation for the record?
Thank you. I'm sorry. My staff told me to do that, too. So this is Sheldon Fisher. I'm the commissioner of the Department of Administration. And I'm joined here by Kate Sheehan, who's the director of the Division of Personnel and Labor Relations. And we're pleased to be here. Thank you. As I mentioned, starting on slide 2, this is conceptually, I think it's important to recognize that a substantial portion of our efforts and services are rendered to the public, and a substantial portion are rendered to other state agencies. And we'll go through each of these in a little bit more detail through the presentation. On slide 3, just to acknowledge that between the department or the Division of Motor Vehicles as well as the Public Defender Agency, we cover most of the state, and we have offices in many regions, in many cities in every region of the state, with a little over 1,000 full-time employees. On slide 4, looking at the divisions that provide services to the public, perhaps the most recognizable is the Division of Motor Vehicles. I think we all have experience there. Interestingly, the division has worked hard over the last few years to try to improve service, to shorten lines, and they're using online services to do that. Last year in 2014, 48% of registrations renewals happened online. I think that's a remarkable number. We're moving towards being able to renew driver's licenses online, and we can even people can do tests, not the official test, but they can do practice exams online to shorten the amount of time that is taken up inside our facilities. And so we're constantly looking at how we can shorten lines and improve service in the Department of Motor Vehicles. We also, the Division of Retirement Benefits is well understood, I think, by most here, and an important part of our responsibilities. We also include the Public Defender Agency and the Office of Public Advocacy. Both of those have constitutionally mandated obligations to provide services. And in the past few years, both of them have experienced fairly dramatic increases in their caseload that is impacting their ability to provide those services as we work to manage our budget at the same time. At the bottom of the page, there are 5 commissions that are more independent commissions. Those are the APOC, the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, the Alaska Public Broadcasting Commission, the Office of Administrative Hearing, and the Violent Crimes Compensation Board. We provide administrative services for those commissions, but recognize that they are independent. Looking into slide 6, in terms of the services that we provide to other state agencies. We've got the Division of Finance, which provides the statewide financial and payroll systems, as well as the e-travel program. We'll talk a little bit more. They're in the midst of a fairly substantial upgrade of our information systems, and we'll talk a little bit about that. There's the Division of General Services that provides manages buildings and space, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. The Division of Personnel and Labor Relations that Kate Sheehan with me manages, and they have the centralized HR function as well as the labor relations and collective bargaining are a large part of their efforts. Enterprise Technology Services is the centralized portion of the IT services in the state, and we'll talk about some opportunities there. And then we have the Division of Risk Management that manages the insurance and risk for the state, and the Division of Administrative Services. On slide six, we've outlined what we believe to be our key focus and initiatives and the challenges that we face in the department. And this, each of these areas are recognized that there's both a function within the department, but also across departments. And we recognize that in our capacity of the Department of Administration, we do have and provide services to others and have provide a leadership role in those areas. And so the first is personnel cost savings. As you know, the state spends about $2.6 billion on personnel. We believe that as we face the budget challenges we face, we need to reduce that cost, and at least in part, that will be through improved productivity, and we're going to be looking for ways to accomplish that. We also have a need, I think, to continue to focus on healthcare spend, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. The second area of focus would be to continue to work to reduce the unfunded liability, particularly in the area of healthcare costs. And again, we'll go into a little bit more detail there. And then we've got procurement savings in terms of trying to reduce the cost for what we purchase today. We spend nearly $2 billion on goods and services as a state, and so even a modest improvements, a modest savings can result in fairly substantial numbers. Information technology is an area that we see a need for emphasis. We've got both centralized and decentralized function, and we see an opportunity to improve that cost as well. And then finally, in terms of facility management, we think there's an opportunity to be more efficient in that area. So these, I'll go into a little bit more detail through each of these, but these are the areas of focus that I'm focused on with the department. Starting at the top, in terms of labor, one of the elements that we need to manage and the department manages is the collective bargaining process. You can see here in the year from 2014 through 2016, the contracts that are in process. I will mention that for last year, 2014, two of the contracts we did not reach final agreement. That was the Marine Engineers Beneficial Association and Masters, Mates, and Pilots, so those will be ongoing. We also have three new contracts this year. The first, Alaska Correctional Officers Association, we reached tentative agreement, but LTC and the Mount Edgecombe teachers, we will be negotiating this year. You can see that next year will be a substantial number of employees. In 2016, we've got two contracts that will cover more than half of our employees.
Mr. Chairman?
Certainly, go ahead.
Yeah, just briefly, this summer when I was out and on the highway a lot wearing out my tires, apparently implemented in either statute or contract, there's the cost of living differential for certain bargaining groups. And the folks I talked to, like, work for Fish and Game, and some of them at DOT, but I think they were saying that their COLA, if you will, was the same as Anchorage and Glen Allen when they have, you know, high fuel costs, high electric costs, and I was wondering if that would be readdressed in these bargaining agreements or if that's driven by something else, but if you could, you know, I know you just took over. So that's an issue out there that I'm concerned about, that because it's kind of hard to retain some of these folks. A few people have left state service because of, you know, these kinds of issues, the high cost of living out in rural Alaska. But anyway, that's a concern. If perhaps you could get back to me or staff could get back to me on where we're at with that and how we can maybe look at making that a little bit more fair for those folks out there.
Through the chair, if it's okay, I'll let Kate address that question.
Hi, Kate. For the record, Kate Sheehan, Director of the Division of Personnel and Labor Relations. Through the chair, Representative Culver. Excuse me. What you're talking about is our geographic differentials. Those are a result of a 2009 McDowell Group study that we did bargain with most of our unions, and it is in statute through SB 95. Currently, we're negotiating with LTC, the Labor's Trades and Crafts, and they do not have that particular geographic differential rates right now. But under statute, a study can be performed every 5 years with an appropriation by the legislature. The last appropriation we had was in 2008, so that's the study we currently have to base the differential rates on.
Okay, so is it, Mr. Chairman, is that the GGU that's affected by that then?
Through the chair, Representative Culver, yes. GGU was one of the unions that we bargained it with. Additionally, the Supervisors Union, the Confidential Employees, Alaska Correctional Officers, and APTECTA, the teachers, they're not affected by that. And neither are the three Marine units.
So that will be a topic of these negotiations, I assume, if it's an issue for them. Thank you.
Actually, I think the court system had one done after that, didn't they?
Mr. Chairman, I do not know the answer to that.
I think it may be unresolved. I'm not positive, but I think nothing was, I don't think there, it was followed up on, if I'm not mistaken. Do you remember, Conrad?
The bill was introduced and passed.
Yeah.
If there are no further questions, I'll continue. Moving to slide 8, this just gives you a sense of the annual salary by different work group. You can see there's a range depending on their the various unions, and then also I think it's important to note that the average employee benefit is roughly 49%. And these numbers do include an average geographic differential included in these numbers. Moving to staff.
Representative Hughes.
Excuse me.
Yeah, Dango, just clarification on the Public Safety Employees Association. There's two numbers. What's AA and AE?
Through the chair. So AA is it covers the troopers, and AP covers the Department of Transportation, police, and, so the airport, police, and fire, and they just have different rates.
Thank you.
Moving on to slide 9, just a little bit of an overview of how the negotiation process works. Obviously, it's governed by statute. We commence the negotiation beginning with the terms of the collective bargaining agreement, and generally the process starts in the fall. There are certain terms and terms such as wages and hours and other terms and conditions that are mandatory that we bargain, and then there's some that we can also add to it as we see the need. By statute, we're required to submit the monetary terms to the legislature for approval no later than the 60th day of the legislative session. In the event that we don't reach agreement, the employees do have various the right to strike, and we'll walk through a little bit of, depending on the category, they.
With respect to the right to strike, I see that it looks like all employees have the right to strike except if they are protective service personnel. And is that just under a state statute, or is it a federal statute, or is it common law, or what is it?
through the chair, Representative Ledoux. It's through the Public Employment Relations Act, which is a state statute. It's in Alaska Statutes 23, Section 40, and it defines the three types of classes of employees. And so the class one is like the police fire protection. So in case of state employees, it would be the troopers, actually all of Department of Public Safety, the correctional officers, and then the different classes are defined.
So is there a local option on that?
Through the chair, not all employers are subject to the Public Employment Relations Act. All state employees are, unless they're exempt or partially exempt, but all classified are.
Thank you.
And so moving to slide 11, this is exactly what Representative Ledoux was referring to. There are three classes of employees. As has been mentioned, class one do not have the right to strike, and they have certain rights that inure to that class as a result. Class two and class three can strike. Class two employees that consist of public utilities and removal and sanitation, educational employees, their right to strike may be limited depending on certain circumstances. Class three may strike if a majority of employees vote to do so. If you look at slide 12, this gives you kind of a roadmap. Assuming that we reach agreement, it's fairly straightforward. The monetary terms are submitted to the legislature, and assuming that they are appropriated, then the contract is finalized. As you can see, in the event of an impasse, those employees that are class one employees that do not have a right to strike have the right to seek arbitration to resolve the disputes. The other classes do not have that right. You can see that there are certain alternatives depending on what we may choose to do. I think it's just important to note that we work very hard to reach agreement and have generally been successful in that. Slide 13, you can see...
Could I interrupt, Commissioner? Just relative to the exempt workers in the state, would simple legislation be all that's required to modify those salaries? Or, I mean, obviously there's no contracts of these sorts, so there's nothing to breach in that respect. Is it just an act of the legislature that would do that?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I'm not sure I understand your question.
Well, let's say someone came to me and said, why does a deputy commissioner earn $200,000? If I were to investigate that and agree with that constituent or stakeholder or whatever, would the answer be that was set by your department or by the legislature? And how would it be modified?
Through the chair, it depends on the employee. The partially exempt salary schedule is set in statute, so that is determined by the legislature. So obviously that could be changed through legislation. The Public Employment Relations Act requires us to bargain wages. So for classified employees, it's set through collective bargaining,
right,
and it's not statutory. For exempt employees, because they're exempt from the Personnel Act, it's set at what it is determined by whoever makes that determination for that particular exempt position.
Okay.
Representative Ledoux.
I guess, who is the whoever?
The governor.
Through the chair, exempt employees in the governor's office, so the governor would make the determination. There's exempt employees in commissions, the Alaska Seafood Marketing, for example. So they would make the decision in consultation with the governor's office. Ultimately, the governor's office is going to determine the salary.
Thank you.
Nothing more. Thanks.
Moving to slide 13, this just provides a sense of the kind of cost of living allowances that have been negotiated over the past. You can see that when the cost of living allowances are negotiated, nobody knows exactly what the CPI will be, and you can see that over time the COLA increases roughly match or somewhere bounded around the cost of living, or the actual CPI increases, generally speaking. Moving to 14, just wanted to provide an example. There are five different contracts we're bargaining this time, and you can see that a 1% increase across that group has different impact depending on the size of the group. As a whole, this amounts to about $2.7 million annually, or $16.3 million over 3 years for each 1% increase in COLA that's offered. As I mentioned previously, we reached a tentative agreement the first two contracts here we were scheduled to be negotiated last year. With master mates and pilots, we actually reached a tentative agreement, but the members failed to ratify that, and so we'll be meeting with them again. And the Marine Engineers Beneficial Association, we've not reached tentative agreement, but continue to work with them. The Alaska Correctional Officers Association, we've reached tentative agreement, and you can see the COLA increases there that were negotiated. Labor Trades and Crafts and the Manage-Com teachers were currently in negotiations. As we reach agreement, we will submit those monetary terms to you for approval, and I think that this suffices to say you'll approve them or not, based on your judgment. Moving then to slide 17, and this has to do with the cost of health insurance, and this actually impacts the state in two ways. First of all, for active employees as well as for retirees. And as you can see, we've had a fairly dramatic increase in costs over the past many years. In fact, for the 30 years since 1982, the Alaska CPI index increased by about 95%, and medical expenses went up over 300%. And so this has been an area that, like all places, medical expenses have exceeded the rate of inflation considerably. Alaska is one of the most expensive states in the nation for medical services. We are actually two times some other states, and so we see both a need and an opportunity to try to continue to reduce costs. You can see in this chart that costs have started to decline in the last year. That has been driven primarily by the replacement of our third-party administrator and engaging Aetna. Aetna brought a more substantial network with reduced costs to bear, and that has helped reduce those costs. We would estimate that moving to Aetna saved us nearly $44 million this year.
I'd like to add one thing, though, but it depends on where you live, how big the network is. There are parts of the state that are still shy a number of professionals. I think last time I talked to somebody in my community, I think there was only one pediatric dentist in town. We worked on real young kids. But I can certainly get back to you on that. But maybe you can bring us up to speed on what's going on with that right now. Because I know that, as I told you last night, I've received a number of complaints on a volume basis, more from retirees, but also from active members. But basically, they're alleging that it's a situation of diminishment of benefits, which we know is probably in violation of their contract, at least, and then probably in violation of several other things, too. But can you comment on that?
Sure. Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to. So the process of a third-party administrator is there are actually, as I understand, over 1.5 million different separate line items within a an administrative plan that has to be administered by Aetna. And so there is, it is a challenge to align and to preserve with precision as you move from one third-party administrator to another. And so certainly we think that there are some benefits and some changes that may be impacting. We have been having conversations, particularly with the retirees, to try to address their concerns and to find solutions so that that their needs are more clearly met. I don't believe there's been a diminishment. I think that the standard does not require one-for-one exactness. It's a generally accepted a program that is roughly comparable, and there can be some pluses and some minuses as long as they kind of match. And but we do hear the frustration and the concern, and so we're taking steps to try to address that.
I think we'll be helping you. I think we're going to be scheduling a meeting in the next couple of weeks to discuss this at length. And you're more than welcome. We would encourage you to participate as well as Aetna. I've had a couple of brief conversations with Aetna, but the calls and the nature of the calls are serious enough to where I believe there's fire with all that smoke. But I don't know if anybody else at the table has had the volume of calls that I have, but I'm seeing some heads nod. But in addition, they're using a subrogation company from outside called the Rollins Company, which, according to the Division of Insurance, is not licensed in Alaska and does not even have a business license in Alaska to attempt to shift the claims from the major medical policy off to an auto policy or workers' comp. That will be looked at in a separate series of meetings. But please continue.
Well,
I'm just getting warmed up.
Well, first of all, let me say that I'll be delighted to engage with you when you have those meetings. I do think this is critical, and critical from both dimensions. In other words, I think that it's critical that we address our medical costs in the state. We have of the $10+ billion of unfunded liability in the pension, $3.6 billion of that is associated with medical care, and so I think it's something that is impactful to each one of us. At the same time, I recognize that there are retirees. This is their medical care, and we need to make sure we provide them the service that they deserve and that they're owed. And so there's a balance, and I look forward to working with all of you to resolve that.
One last question, I think, at least for now. Up until a year or two ago, the state, specifically one of your predecessors, was looking at something called medical tourism. And the state was exploring the possibility of sending people primarily down to Seattle for specialized treatment, along with a caregiver, a member of their family, a spouse, or a member of their family, put them up in a hotel for a week down there, have them treated at University Hospital or Harvard U or Swedish, wherever, based on the specialty. And oftentimes, the projection was that even after all the travel expenses and the other things that they were providing, it would be 40% or 50% less than having it done in Anchorage. Are you still looking at that? Are we still exploring the possibility of medical tourism?
Yes, we're looking at everything, and so I think that's an interesting statistic in and of itself, that dynamic exists. I think demonstrates that some of the challenges we're trying to overcome.
And actually, I can provide you with the top 25 or 50 procedures based on I think six Western states. Primarily, it was developed for workers' compensation, but it's going to be the same price. And on some procedures, it's 300-350% of what it is outside. But for saying they do.
Has the state ever considered working with the federal government to allow more physicians into this country if they are willing to work in Alaska or remote areas? Because I know the way it stands now, if you're a physician, that really doesn't get you up to the top of the queue with respect to immigration. A nurse can get in a lot easier than a physician can. So, I mean, and I realize that that's a federal immigration matter, but has the state considered actually trying to work with the feds and see whether or not there could be an exemption carved out so that someone is willing to work in a remote area such as Alaska, they could get up to the top of the queue?
Through the chair, that's a great suggestion. I'm not aware that we've ever had an initiative, but I've written it down, and I think that's an interesting opportunity to explore whether we could solve some of the issues we face. Thank you.
And for the benefit of the people in the room that might not be familiar with the phrase medical tourism, but it's not an original thought. The number of unions in Alaska have been doing it since the pipeline days. In fact, one of the unions had two Learjets that they were using frequently to medevac people down to Seattle for specialized treatment. And it's been around for a long time. Just not on a large scale. What's able to do?
It's used by a number of countries right now, actually.
There are no further questions on that. Moving to slide 19, I think most of you are familiar with a graph like this or something like this that shows the steep increase of benefits that are due through PERS and TERS in the coming decades. I guess one of the points that I would bring, in addition to just visually the impact, is that, you know, we've got a few years to, I think, really make a difference and try to reduce these costs. And if we can, there will be substantial benefit as we move through those very heavy years, in the coming decades. And so certainly I feel a lot of urgency to be as aggressive as early as we can so we don't miss that opportunity. Again, as I mentioned before, the unfunded liability here is just over $10 billion.
Mr. Chairman. Representative Kito.
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner. Question I have, I guess you see this graph go steeply up and then back down again. This graph includes medical costs or health care as well as retirement. I understand that existing Tier 1, Tier 2 will be fading and those people will go down unless we add another system of Tier 5. But even with the current Tier 4, aren't we expected to have medical cost liabilities for retirees into the future?
Through the chair, yes, of course we will have medical cost liabilities. What you're seeing is a combination of the demographics as well as the nature of Tiers 1 through 3 that are impacting those years. Tier 4, we've worked quite hard to ensure that there's not an unfunded cost associated with that, and as it gets out, the burden on the retirement plan will be less.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, the right after we adjourned at the end of April, there were a series of articles in the press about how legislation shifting to the trust, the $3 billion, was well and good, but that we re-amortized things such that in the end that would be consumed by a new scheduled payout. Do you have any comment about that? That we've sort of back-ended this thing and left a somewhat larger problem for our grandchildren?
If you can go to slide 20, this may help answer that question. I don't know if I've got a complete answer, but what you see here is the $3 billion payment that was made last year, and you can see that in the early years, well, first of all, the green line represents what would have been the amortization schedule, and then you can see the blue and red line beneath that represents the forecasted schedule at this stage, and you do see that in the out years it appears that there'll be a sort of a crossover, and so as I understand it, it did push some of those costs further out. I don't know if that answers your question specifically.
I mean, it's only that in this fiscal climate, it's tough to change course, at least this year or next year. But it's a concern that some of us have had.
Representative Kito.
Thank you, Commissioner. Just as a follow-on to that, I guess I do have a concern that if we extend our amortization out too far, we're back into the situation of paying a lot more in interest that we might not be able to afford.
Through the chair, I'm noting your concerns, and let us look at that schedule and consider the different options that might be available for that.
On page 19, would it be possible to break out the retirement portion and the medical component into two charts, rather than having a composite?
We'll look to do that. Yes. I don't have that with me, but we'll look.
Oh, yeah,
that.
That's been expected. Thank you. Certainly. Representative Hughes.
Yeah, this is going back a little bit, but I remember a presentation, maybe it had been 2 years, about a plan to have some kind of, I'm not sure what it was called, some kind of health care management for state employees that was supposed to bring savings. Did that happen, and have we realized savings? And I believe maybe, I'm not sure if it was also going to apply to retirees, but you know what I'm talking about? It was like a nurse call-in line or something that was supposed to bring some savings, help people follow the doctor's orders and stay healthy.
Telemed.
Is that it?
That was the bill. I don't know if anything's happened out of it.
You know, I'm not entirely clear. I do know that there's a certain amount, of telemedicine and those kinds of activities for rural Alaska that have been implemented and have been effective. I don't know if that's referring precisely to what you're referring to or not.
So there's not some kind of program like that that we have as part of health insurance for state employees and retirees?
Lifeline.
let me introduce Andy Mills, who is one of my special assistants.
And I only have the benefit of being on a few more days than the new commissioner. So Andy Mills, special assistant for the Department of Administration. Perhaps what you might be referring to is the wellness program that we put into place several years ago, and that certainly was an initiative that dealt with a voluntary wellness committee that would bring ideas forward. We did Weight Watchers at Work and a number of other initiatives that focused on employee health, and there was also an employee assistance program, which was kind of a counseling line. Those were among the many things that were implemented, and then there was telemedicine and some other concepts like on-site clinics, which we had discussed but were not implemented. Was that maybe?
Mm-hmm.
So have we tracked to see if we realized any savings from that, and are we going to continue it, is my question, if it did realize savings?
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, on the wellness in particular, it's difficult to track some of those, so I don't think that we have, but we can check with our folks to see if there was something measurable. Some of these are certainly better health and long term than something you quantify as dollars, but we can always check.
Just a follow-up. When it was proposed to us, the whole idea was that it was going to bring savings. Of course, we want Alaskans to be healthier, but it was all about savings. So I believe that there was supposed to be, something measurable out of it. At least it was presented to us that it would do that. So I would like follow up on that if you can find out more information.
We'll look into that. Thank you. Moving to slide 21, the third area that we are focused on is trying to improve the procurement in the state. As I mentioned, between goods and services, we procure nearly $2 billion of goods and services. Some of that is centrally managed in the Department of Administration. Some of it is managed in the various departments. We do think that based on some benchmarks that we use, that in the past year we saved nearly $60 million, but it's an area that we think that is ripe for additional savings and focus, and we'll be looking at that. On slide 22, as I mentioned, the Department of Finance is implementing a new information system. We refer to it as IRIS. This will replace aging systems that are currently in operation and allow a more complete and comprehensive view of financial information as well as purchasing information. We are right now in the final stages of the go live and testing, and we expect to make that transition for phase three of financial management in July of this year. There will be a phase four that will include HR and payroll that will be next year. At this stage, we're on schedule and on budget, and excited about the capability that this will bring. Slide 23, we have a self-serve site that our vendors can use. This includes RFPs and various grants. It also allows them, our vendors, to receive certain information in terms of status, invoice status, and other things, facilitates both efficiency and hopefully more competitive bids in our processes. Moving to slide 24, as I mentioned, IT services in the state are both centralized through ETS and decentralized in the department. The total spend within the administration is roughly $220 million. About $38 million of that is within ETS. I'm concerned, many people are concerned, that what we've got now results in somewhat siloed and department-centric view, where there's inconsistent standards and oftentimes a duplication of effort as each department asks and answers the same questions, sometimes in an inconsistent way. And so we're right now doing some work, partly at the request of the legislature and partly through our own efforts, to look at the right structure, a recommended structure that would both improve the level of service and reduce the cost of delivering that service in the future.
Representative Kino.
Thank you, Commissioner. Can you let me know, was there a time when there was a centralized IT service? Was that a change that was made in the past?
Through the chair, I understand that there have been times in the distant past where there's been eight more centralized. I don't know if it's been 100% centralized, but I do think there's kind of been an ebb and flow over the years. I don't have the details on that.
Thank you.
Moving to slide 25, and this sort of is the last area of focus, which is our building management. We manage, I believe it's 19 buildings. It's about 1.6 million square feet of space in state-owned buildings, and then we actually have another more than 350 leases with another 3.9 million square feet of space. Within the state-owned buildings, we're about 97% occupied, which we're pleased with, but we are looking to always reduce cost, try to move as many people into state-owned facilities as possible because the cost of those facilities is less. One of the tools that I know was presented last year and is addressed in slide 26 is the use of space standards. This is the process of trying to upgrade the space, upgrade the cubicles, and get a higher density of workers. We've made a few changes now, but we have put a pause on this. We're going to complete the projects that are currently in process and then wait until we as an administration have a more clear view of the what the departments are going to look like. I think as we go through this budget exercise, we're concerned that there will be reductions and changes that would require that we make further adjustments, and we want to see that process mature a little bit before we finalize this space.
Representative Colter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This space reorganization is very unpopular with rank-and-file employees, and they don't see it as a cost-saving measure because of all the expense has gone to all these new office equipment. And I would hope that you would kind of solicit input, as the governor has done with the budget, to get some ground truth and some feedback on the people that do the work. They know what will work most efficiently, and to implement it statewide in all office buildings perhaps wasn't the right way. I'm sure that there's economies of scale and locating people close together, but some of the comments I've heard is that, you know, four people in one cubicle, there's no way that you can really talk with someone on state business. You're lacking the kind of confidentiality, security. And I'm sure that folks within the department have heard these comments. And I'm not sure if it trickled, what the trickle back or the explanation was, but I think you have a chance to maybe, you know, I like what you're saying, you're on reset there and to examine that. So I would encourage that, and perhaps down the road you can check back in with us and see how that, let us know how that's working out.
To the chair,
Representative Hito.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I would agree with Representative Culver's comments. I think it's very important not to look at what we can do for an individual from the top down, but make sure that we are making sure that we're providing the state employee with the space and the resources they need to do their job adequately. And every employee is not going to have the same job as every other one, so their needs are different. I would hope the department is working with commissioners of other departments to make sure that space is being adequately identified for individual job classes within the different departments. Thank you.
Through the chair, thank you. We are right now, in fact, I've got meetings scheduled on Friday with union representatives and others examining some of those complaints and trying to make sure we address those needs. I do know, I've reviewed some of the material. Of course, I wasn't here as this process was put forward. I've reviewed some of the materials. I do think that there has been a trend nationwide, not just in Alaska, to try to use space more efficiently. And so we'll be looking at that. I think that we need to, I do think that we can use our space more efficiently than it has been in the past. And whether this is the right answer or not, we'll come back to you and give you some thoughts. But I think that what is being done here is not inconsistent with other initiatives, both in the private and public sector. Moving to slide 27.
Representative Hughes.
Yeah, and just while we're talking about space, and in addition to the individual physical space per employee, what have you looked at, or would you look at all the state facilities across the state? And I guess I'm hoping, and making a comment rather than a question, hoping that you would look to wherever we could be co-locating and be more efficient. The Transportation Committee asked the question of, they showed a map with all where they had facilities all over the state, and they weren't able to tell me if any of those were co-located with anything else. I think they were aware of one, but it seems like it would make sense, for instance, to have the troopers and DOT out in the rural areas sharing a facility, and I just encourage that as we are in a lean time, that we work to be co-locating state facilities to save money whenever possible.
If you go back to one of the earlier slides, we often do co-locate, but I agree with you that there's probably an opportunity to do more and be more efficient and to aggregate space. So I've taken note. Thank you. Looking at slide 27, one of the areas we manage is the insurance and well, management insurance and catastrophic fund. You can see we've had a couple, a handful of fairly large, high-impact events in the past year. Happy to talk about any one of those if there's an interest.
Well, since the commissioner is happy to do that, and actually the middle one draws my eye a little bit. Is that a covered event?
Actually, yesterday I said it wasn't, but I was mistaken. It is a covered event. We had a $1 million deductible, and the balance was covered through multiple insurance companies, and so our exposure there is capped at $1 million.
It's not something I would insure. But
what's that?
It's not something I would have insured.
But I guess there's a price for everything.
I would guess there's a possibility of recovery from the responsible.
I've had a conversation on that, and I think there's still an investigation ongoing, and so we don't know where that will end up. But that will largely be between the insurance companies and the launch. So, any other questions? All right, the last few slides I'll just hit fairly quickly. We have had these three slides represent three office buildings that we've renovated: the Nome State Office Building, Douglas Island here that I'm sure you're all familiar with, and then the Geological Materials Center in Anchorage. With each of these renovations, we've actually improved the efficiency of the buildings by updating the insulation and the thermal characteristics of the building. In particular, the Geologic Materials Center, I know the team was quite pleased that they were able to secure a building and renovate it really at a fraction of the cost, almost half the cost of what it would have cost to build new construction, and they're also able to get into that space 2 years early. So we will continue to look for those kind of opportunities in the future.
You're missing one of the bigger remodel projects in the state, aren't you, on this?
Well, are you which project are you referring to? We would be happy to manage that, but we don't manage that right now.
Transparent building.
Nice elevator. Actually, the building came out nice. I haven't been in it yet, but from the outside, it is.
Finkelstein
was still. I might add the Kenai's on the cutting edge. We co-locate with DOT, OCS, Weights and Measures, and who else? Is that it? The LIO. And four legislative offices.
And we need to do more of that if we can save cost. I agree with the comments that have been made that's an important tool as we try to drive savings from our facilities.
Representative Hughes.
I have a lingering question from way back early in the presentation. Since DMV falls under you, we talked about how we hear from constituents regarding health insurance and things. Another one we hear about is about their experience at DMV from time to time. And one that I heard from recently was from a constituent who was HB 19 allowed permanent vehicle registration, you know, as a local option. And so in the Matsu Borough, that passed. And at DMV, the person said they stood in line for an hour, and then they got up to the counter. They found out that the particular category, I don't know if they had a veterans, a specialty license or something, but it was not, they couldn't get the permanent vehicle registration because they were in a certain category. And the person had looked up the information on DMV's website before going in, didn't see anything about exemptions, and that it is something that seems like should be posted online, and I'm not sure why there would be certain things exempted. But I just thought I'd make you aware of that situation, and it's in limited places in the state, so it's kind of a unique situation. But so that DMV will just be a little more user-friendly in that regard and get the information posted online.
Can Honorable Chair, thank you. I've taken a note. I think that while this is a specific case, I would agree with you 100%. The general point is that we need to try to make the DMV a customer-friendly experience. I think that for many people, the way their experience at the DMV almost defines their perception of government. And so we recognize that. And as I said before, I think that they've tried in prior administrations to improve service. They've certainly moved a fair number of things online. And when they do that, that reduces the queues and the waiting times. And so we'll continue that effort. Thank you.
Actually, one of the good things they did was on the website, you can go, at least in probably over half of the DMVs, you can look them up and get real-time cameras and see what the lines are before you drive down there. And it actually works unless you do it right after school when the kids can get over there before you can get over there, you know, drive over. But it works most of the time that way.
Great.
Any further questions? Thanks.
Thank you.
Again, got a feeling we'll be seeing you probably once a week for your budget subcommittee.
I look forward to that. Thank you.
And with that, we will adjourn at 4:12.